morning. Good morning again. I have to tell you, this is the first time I've ever given a presentation in a movie theater, and I quite like it. It's actually very cool. I was going to insert a slide reminding everyone to silence their mobile phones, but I didn't have enough time. So thank you for being here. Welcome to Tech Days. We have a lot to cover today. We have a lot to talk about. We're going to take an end-to-end view of the developer platform. We're going to talk about devices. We're going to talk about cloud computing. We're going to talk about developer tools. But I think that'll make a lot more sense if we spend a minute or two just really setting some context about how we look at the world of apps, how we look at the world of app development, and more importantly, what's changed over the past couple of years or so. Now, last fall, our CEO, Steve Ballmer, sent out a letter to shareholders. It was the annual shareholder letter that we always send out at the end of the fiscal year, looking back on the year in review and then looking ahead toward the opportunities for the company. And each of these letters, year in and year out, they're all unique in their own right just because of all the fast-changing dynamics of our industry. But this letter was a little bit different. This was the first time in which the opportunities for Microsoft to our shareholders were framed through the lens of the company as a devices and services company. And this was kind of a big deal. A lot of people took notice of this because this was really the first time in the 30-plus year history of the company that we'd really talked about that set of opportunities as anything other than a commercial packaged software company. That's what we've always been. We're basically a big ISV selling platform technology and packaged products to customers. But the world has changed. If you look at the work we've done in Xbox and Office 365 and Windows Azure, we've actually been down this road for several years now. But this was a fairly public-facing statement from the highest levels of the company that we had essentially broken from the past and were looking toward a very different and even more prosperous future. And so this was, I think, as much of a statement about Microsoft and how we think about our business, but also a statement about how we think about the opportunity for our customers, our partners, our technical communities, all the people, the ecosystem around the company that essentially comes along for the ride and profits from that along the way. And in a lot of ways, this is our new reality. So just look at devices. You know, in 2002, the number of wireless devices, number of mobile phones, rather, surpassed the number of landline-connected phones in the world. And then in 2011, the number of mobile devices in the world exceeded the number of human beings in the world. I think we cleared 6 billion. And so by 2020, we're looking at a world of some 50 billion devices. And this has profound implications for developers because depending on what your business goals are, reach, distribution, getting your application, your experience on as many of those screens as possible, this is both an opportunity but also a challenge. Getting on all these screens, getting on all these devices, it gets a little bit daunting. So we're going to talk a little bit later about what we're doing in the platform to make that easier for you. But in a lot of ways, this is the world we live in. We're going to talk today primarily around PC, tablet, and phone. But as you all know, screens range from the smallest of screens on embedded devices to 80-inch touch screens like we have with Perceptive Pixel. So on the device front, this is really kind of how the world looks. And on the services side, services in the back end are becoming increasingly common and ubiquitous for these device experiences. I think the market for public cloud services today is on the order of $30 billion U.S., and IDC predicts this will go to $70 billion U.S. by the year 2015. That's a staggering rate of growth. That's roughly four times the rate at which IT spending worldwide is going to grow. So we see the market for this getting bigger and bigger. We see applications that are interesting showing up in the market, and by now, virtually all of them have some sort of cloud service running in the back end. So part of the big theme for today is modern apps. Well, what is a modern app? We hear this term all the time. It's used by different people in different ways. We have a point of view about what this entails, and I think three of the big things are here in terms of modern apps being increasingly connected. It's hard to think of an application experience today that's relevant, that matters, that doesn't have some sort of service in the back end. And even games, which were always sort of the last holdout, right? Games, because they're so dependent on performance, have to run close to the metal. But even games use cloud services in the back end today for things like multiplayer, matchmaking lobbies, and so forth. And so as these apps become increasingly connected across multiple screens and then running services in the back end, we think this is going to be a kind of a key component of what constitutes a modern app. We think customers expect this. We think people expect their experiences and their data and their personalization and configurations and settings to travel from device to device. It's no longer a differentiating feature. It's now just expected. We think another big attribute is that these apps will become increasingly personal, and I would include social in this. You know, we talk a lot about the notion of making the device about you and the things you care about. I think as the world of work and play sort of meld together in the context of these devices, people don't use two devices anymore, one for work and one for play. They just use devices for getting through the day. I would include social in this to the extent that, you know, it used to be when you wrote an app, you could just sit down and have a decent set of CRUD APIs and just, you know, write an app. If you can create, read, update, and delete something, that those were the fundamental building blocks of how you build an app. And in a lot of ways, create, read, update, and delete has been replaced or augmented by things like, follow, friend, and share. Right? These are the verbs that kind of describe what people expect from software. And also, the last piece is that these apps are going to become increasingly natural. And that doesn't mean that the mouse and keyboard gets replaced. Obviously, we have an ecosystem of over 700,000 applications that are certified, that were certified for Windows 7 at the launch of Windows 7. Those apps are still there. They just run on Windows 8. Most of them are mouse and keyboard driven. But there's a new generation of applications showing up that take increasing dependence on pen, touch, gesture, voice, sometimes combinations of those, all of these sort of multimodal inputs. And so here's an example. This particular photo, this is a device. It's a giant Coke machine, but it is a device. Anything with a microprocessor can run software. And what Coca-Cola has done is they've basically built this very interactive Coke machine using a Kinect sensor that you see in the little black box below the screen as the input mechanism that detects proximity of a potential customer. In this particular case, they're in a shopping mall in Seoul, South Korea, and when they walk past the sensor, it says, hey, I want to challenge you to a dance contest, and if you meet the challenge, you get a free Coke. So rather than bore everyone with a description of how all this works, let's just take a look and see for yourself. What do you think? That's a modern app. Part of the reason I wanted to show that is just sort of open up the thinking about
how we can combine hardware and software into some of these new experiences that break out of the norms that some of us have come to know and expect. So I want to start by really giving somewhat of a business update, I think, on Windows 8. One of the things that we've noticed and seen, for good reason, I think, the last couple of years, is that the developer community pays a lot more attention to the business of platforms, and for good reason. Dev cycles are precious time. You certainly don't want to squander those precious cycles on targeting application platforms that aren't going to stand the test of time or be successful in the marketplace or help you reach whatever your goals are, reaching people, making money, whatever the case may be. So before we start talking about what we're doing in the platform from a technology standpoint, we should talk about the business a little bit. As we announced in January, we've sold 60 million licenses of Windows 8, which puts us roughly on par with Windows 7, but we're in a much more competitive environment today. So we feel good about that trajectory. Things get better and better as more devices come to market. There's some 1,800 systems certified for Windows 8 today and more coming. And I'm sure you've probably heard a lot of the original equipment manufacturers and device makers talk about the increasing dependence on touch and that's a real opportunity for them to sell more hardware. I have some interesting telemetry data to share with you in a few moments about touch, but that's a big, big piece of this. And I think Lenovo in particular, were very forthcoming. And they said publicly they underestimated the level of excitement around touch and that they're going to tool up and actually double down on that as they bring new devices to market. And we've heard similar feedback from other equipment makers. So every performance indicator that we have around how things are going with Windows is certainly trending positive. I think the thing that's probably of more interest to this group is what's going on with apps in the App Store. Well, we've seen a four-fold increase in app downloads since launch, in the 3 months since launch. We recently crossed the 100 million download threshold for downloads of apps from the store. Every week since October, since the launch of Windows 8, we've seen double-digit increases in the number of unique visitors to the store, so that just continues to kind of to snowball and increase. And on Christmas Day alone, we saw 150% increase in app downloads just on that day compared to a normal day in December, which was more than any other platform provider saw on Christmas Day. I think the iPad saw 140%, slightly less, and iOS in general was somewhere around 85, 90%. So we actually did quite well with the holiday bump. It only gets better from here, but there are tens of thousands of apps in the store today, obviously many of them here local in Belgium. But this is truly a global opportunity. When you put an app in the App Store, you never know where the next download is going to come from. So the companies that are building apps for Windows 8, I think you saw a little bit of it in the walk-in videos where developers and a lot of the companies that have put apps in the store are talking about the fact that the opportunity is so big it simply can't be ignored. There's too many devices out there, too many potential people to reach to not put some time and energy into getting your app on Windows 8. So I'm going to play a video where another customer is talking about that very thing, but also the way it helps them differentiate their offering in the marketplace and the way they take unique advantage of what Windows has to offer in the platform to really make their experience stand out.
Content is at the heart of every successful organization. Customers need to access their content wherever they are. They need to share, they need to collaborate, they need to move their business forward with content. Box provides the solutions to let our customers do that. And so for us, Windows 8 is the opportunity to be on that many more devices, that many more platforms.
What's really exciting about our app on Windows 8 is that we have the ability to plug into the actual file system of Windows 8. So when you're out picking a file or choosing a file to open, Box can be there as a natural extension of the file system. So let's say you're in Mail and you want to pick an attachment. When I select attachments, what's happening is that you're seeing the Windows file picker appear. Let's say you want to pick a file from Box. The whole app is here. You can actually sort by date, you can do semantic zoom, and when you find the file you want, you can just select it and attach it. So that file came from Box straight into your email without you having to open the Box app separately.
When you look at Windows 8 and kind of the different user experience, it doesn't lose the core fundamental need that people have to create files, to be able to share them, to be able to collaborate, which is what we bring to the Windows 8 platform.
There's guidelines for everything from how high the header is to horizontal scrolling and how the content should look. All these principles really led itself to a really fun design process because we could follow these guidelines but also be creative.
It is a fantastic platform that is really redefining how people interact with software. And that's part of what Box is about as well, is creating an experience for users that is so intuitive and easy to use that they almost forget that they're interacting with software or technology. They're just getting done what they need to get done.
Windows 8 is a groundbreaking opportunity for Box. It's a brand new platform. We are really excited to be on it, and it's going to open up a whole new set of users for us.
You know, it's so great working with all these different partners because they all have a different take on what the Windows 8 opportunity means to them. They're obviously very sort of focused on the goals of their business, as one would imagine, and the opportunity means, I think, something a little different to every customer, every partner that we talk to, but it's just great seeing all this continued energy around putting apps on Windows 8. Whoops. Back up a moment. So let's talk a little bit about what we're doing in the platform. I mentioned a moment ago that we have some interesting data relative to touch. As we've said from the very beginning of Windows 8, or the launch of Windows 8, it was built for touch first. And if you use Windows 8, you probably remember the first login experience where we ask you, hey, are you willing to share some information with us to help make the Windows 8 experience better? And lots of people say yes to that. And we get all sorts of interesting telemetry data back. And so three months after launch, we have some very, I think, interesting ahas and surprises about how clearly the user experience is, how different it is on touch-enabled devices versus non-touch-enabled devices. It turns out on touch-enabled devices, people are twice as likely to use the search charm, for example. They're 2.5 times more likely to use the share charm. They're 2.5 times more likely to use snapped views for multitasking, and they're 4.5 times more likely to use a Windows Store app relative to a desktop app. So it was a very clear delineation around when you have a touch-enabled device, you simply use the product differently. We have all sorts of other data describing how fast the learning curve is for a lot of people. Once they figure out gestures and swipes and all the tips and tricks of how to get to the different features of Windows, the usage of all these unique features that we put into the platform ramp very, very quickly. There's an integrated store on every Windows 8 device. I'm actually going to talk about that a little bit later. But the thing I do want to spend a moment on is the application of existing development skills and assets. I think, as everyone knows by now, from a platform standpoint, this is the biggest turn of the crank, the biggest revision that we've done in the platform for Windows since the introduction of Win32 and Windows 95. And one of the design points here was to take the existing set of assets and skills in the development community today and bring them forward into Windows 8. So if you're a .NET developer and you're very, very steeped in C# and XAML, or if you're a native developer in C++, you can bring the familiarity with those languages, those skills, your knowledge of Visual Studio into Windows 8 and build Windows Store apps. If, however, you're a web developer and you've bet your career on HTML and JavaScript and CSS and you've seen the same thing that we've seen in terms of JavaScript increasingly becoming a general purpose programming language as the performance and the tools get better and better and better, you can actually build HTML5 apps for Windows 8. And, you know, people talk about web versus native. In the context of HTML5. A lot of people just associate HTML5 with web, and they associate apps running locally on the device as non-web. We've given you the ability to take HTML5 and actually do both. Hardware-accelerated full-screen experiences in IE, and take that same code base, that same set of skills, that same set of language familiarity over to Windows 8 and actually run on the platform itself. So what I'd like to do is invite Ben Riga up to give us a quick look at how that works from a developer experience. Ben?
Good morning. Can you hear me? Is my mic on? Now it's on. Excellent. Good morning. So I am going to spend some... Whoops. I'm going to log in first. I'm going to spend some time talking about HTML5 on Windows 8 and Windows Phone and show you something I think is a story that is not as well known as it probably should be, just how easy it is to do something like that. And what's not easy is typing your password correctly in front of 2,000 people. Ah. Okay, that works better. And let me switch over. Excellent. Okay, so I'm going to take an app that was built for the web. It's actually a game. It's called Yeti Bowl. So let's have a look. So let's see how it behaves on the web. So this is just a very simple game. And I'll just run it. And here you'll see that I have my Abominable Snowman up at the top there. And you see that as I drop these boulders, I'm using touch there, and I can use, I can use all sorts of functions there to make the ball go in different directions and so on. So this is, as you would expect, a pure HTML app. It is running in the browser, right? So it resizes and all of that good stuff. In fact, let's do something crazy for a Microsoft thing. Let's actually use this other browser called Chrome, and it also runs quite well. I mean, I can drop, and we should hear the... I don't know why the sounds are louder on Chrome. There we go. Okay, so we have this game. It's great. It's written on the web. It's pure HTML using all the standard HTML5 stuff. And so let's see how easy it would be to take that game and move it directly into Windows 8. So in Visual Studio, I'll just create a new project. Let me just start a new project here. And I am going to use JavaScript. So I'm just going to use a blank app, and I'll just call it Yeti BE. How about that? I'll create the new project. And now it's creating a blank project. Now, of course, this is a standard Windows application, and so it's got a blank screen. It's all HTML. Visual Studio 2012 for Windows 8 supports that quite well. So I've got standard JavaScript, I've got HTML, I've got CSS, all the typical stuff. So what I'm going to do is grab all of my game. I'm just going to grab the whole thing and just grab it and copy it over to my project. And I'm going to just let it copy everything in. And you can see now I've got my extra CSS, my JavaScript, and I've got this game file. Now, this project, because it's a standard Windows project, uses default HTML. So I'm going to change that in the manifest and say rather than when you launch using rather than using default.html, let's open game.html. And that's really the only change I need to make. If I run this, I'm now running the app. You'll see it launch. And now here you'll see it's full screen, as you would expect from a Windows 8 app. There is no Chrome. And of course, I can drop, and we can see the standard stuff. So again, pretty simple stuff. Now, of course, since it's a Windows 8 app, if I go out to the start screen, you'll see there's my Yeti BE. If I close this and go back to my, while I have that manifest open, let's actually make it look a little better. So rather than having I'm going to choose some logos here. That, and delete that one. Logo, I can even add a splash screen if I want. And of course, I can even have a wide logo so that when my user sees it on their screen, they will see the full wide screen there, and that will hopefully invite them back to run the application directly on the app. So if I run this, you see, first of all, I'll see the splash screen. Now, I'm not going to run it. Let's just go back to the start screen, and you'll see now that there's the Yeti BE that we just created. If I right-click, I can make my tile bigger and so on. So this is a full native Windows 8 application. It runs as fast as any of the other applications. As you saw, it's a game. It's HTML5, and it runs quite well. The next step would be, how can I reuse this code also in Windows Phone? So let's go back to... let's go back to Visual Studio. Let's create a new application. And this time, we'll go to C Sharp. So let's create this Yeti WPBE. I think I used that one yesterday. Let me say 1-1. And accept that. And now we'll see a new project. Now, it's going to be a little different. This time, it's going to be for phone. And so we'll see that all of the HTML assets are here. Now, of course, I don't want these. I'm going to replace these, so I'm going to delete them. And I'm also going to delete all the references to them. So let me come down here. I'm going to delete that and that. And I think there's another line. Here it is, down there. So that's all the standard stuff that Visual Studio put into my template. And so now I'm going to grab those exact same files. I'm going to grab them, drop them into my HTML directory. And again, we see that same thing. But now the way Windows Phone does it is there's this browser control that's in my main page. And so let me go directly into my main page and add some things here. So first thing I'll add is the source. And I'll make that equal to HTML game.html. And let me also say is script enabled equal to true. Whoops. True. And I think I'm good. Let's actually run this. Let me choose the right emulator since I have that one running already. And so it's compiling it, it's deploying it, and here's my app that's running in the browser on Windows Phone. This is a standard app. Same thing. Now, one of the things you might notice is if I double tap, it does this crazy thing where it's actually zooming in. And of course, as a game, I don't want that. So let's come back and do one more thing. In the CSS, we'll open the style sheet. And one of the things we need to change here is, say, MS Touch Action, and we're going to say is none. Semicolon. If I run this, all right, and so now if I double tap, it just works, right? So let me stop this, or we're going to hear this game. So in a few minutes, what I've shown you is that I've taken this app that was developed purely for the web. I've ported it very quickly to Windows 8 with very few changes, one line of code. Same thing, I was able to move that exact same game to Windows Phone and run that in a browser in Windows Phone. So what does that tell you? It tells you that HTML is a standard, it's coming. Of course, C# and C++ are not going away, but for web developers that understand and are comfortable with and have the skills around HTML and JavaScript and CSS, they are welcome to our platform. And certainly we hope that if you are a web developer, that you'll start engaging and start building your apps in the skills that you know today. Thank you.
Table. There we go. Oh, there we go. Thank you. So we talked earlier about, I think, the need to be on multiple screens, having your experience travel and show up across multiple devices in order to differentiate. We think that's just going to continue to be an attribute of modern apps. And if you believe, like we do, that HTML5 represents a really good path to being on as many devices as possible, certainly on the platform as it relates to Windows 8 and in the browser as it relates to non-Windows devices, we really feel good about the investment that we've made there, and we just continue to see energy and momentum in the developer community around HTML5 apps running on Windows. So just to underscore that it's not all about apps and games and a lot of the things that we show that tend to demo quite well, we're seeing great uptake for Windows 8 in business. For companies that are using software to engage customers on Windows devices in a very outbound-facing way, like Bank of America and Johnson & Johnson, companies like that, as well as companies that are driving productivity scenarios, like British Telecom, that's outfitted a number of their field engineers with Windows tablets so they can actually do job updates while they're on the go. And Emirates Airlines. Now, this is an airline that has a reputation for setting the gold standard for customer service. They've outfitted all of their pursers and cabin crew with HP tablets to deliver even a higher degree of personalized customer service for Emirates passengers. And so far, it's absolutely going great. They saw the opportunity with Windows 8 to do something very, very differentiated, and it's just been a great, great experience working with them and a number of other customers as well. Now let's talk about the phone. Ben showed a little bit of what we're doing on the phone, but I want to give a business update on what's happening with Windows Phone as well. We actually had a terrific quarter with a phone, and we get a lot of data and a lot of input from a lot of our partners in retail about what's happening in the channel, because that's the point at which purchase intent is actually converted to an actual purchase. And we've had actually a great quarter. Since the launch of Windows Phone 8, we've seen three times as many consumers walk into retail asking for a Windows Phone. We've seen four times as many of our partners recommending Windows Phone. We gather a lot of this data through market research. Twice as many of them are actually carrying Windows Phone. This is huge. This is 12 weeks since launch. We've doubled the number of places in the world you can actually buy a Windows Phone. Four out of five of them say that the brand has an upward trajectory in terms of affinity with consumers walking into the store. We've overtaken BlackBerry in a number of markets. We have higher share than Apple in seven markets. We have double-digit market share in four markets. And the headline here is that we've shipped four times as many phones since the launch of Windows 8 compared to the same quarter in the previous year. So it's absolutely been great. But I think you're probably more interested in what's happening on the developer and storefront, and that's been quite positive as well. Since launch, 15,000 new apps submitted into the store. That's two times the rate that we saw with the release of the Windows Phone 7 SDK. 41,000 new developers registered since the launch of Windows 8. That's 1.5 times the rate of increase that we saw with Windows Phone 7, a huge increase in app downloads, over 90% increase in revenues paid out to developers, and 46 of the top 50 apps in the world as measured by popularity on Android and iOS are in the Windows Phone store today. There's over 130,000 apps in the store today, and this is truly a global opportunity. Windows Phone is in nearly 200 markets around the world. We pay out revenues to developers in 50 currencies. And so, as I mentioned earlier, when you write an app for Windows Phone, you put it in the store, you'd never really know where your downloads are going to come from, depending on how and where it's localized. Now, we've shipped a number of new platform features in Windows 8. I'll run through these quickly. You know, developers are a pretty vocal bunch, and when they don't get what they want, they let us know, and we'd like it like that. And that's really what happened in the wake of the launch of Windows Phone 7, which we described as a stepping stone toward the realization of a platform vision on the phone.
And as we processed the request through the engineering process of Windows Phone 8, we delivered a lot of great stuff. One of the things we asked for was the ability to make it easier to build fast, fluid UI. We've done that. We've added new controls. We've increased the performance of some of the more important controls. So if you're using things like grids and lists and panoramas, your apps will noticeably be faster. Yes, for the ability to do more with live tiles. You have three sizes of live tile to work with now, and in addition, you can actually send notifications to the lock screen, and you can update the lock screen wallpaper with your app. We got a lot of requests for speech. There's now a fully featured speech platform in Windows Phone 8. We got a lot of requests for the improvements to the Dev Center in the store. We've done that. It's much more efficient, transparent, and clean process. And you can make more money through things like in-app purchasing as well. We got requests for deeper integration into some of the phone experiences. So we've done things like open up the camera, for instance, so you can build integrated lens applications. We got requests for better multitasking. We delivered that in Windows Phone 8, so now you can do things like track location and background while your app is running. We got requests for better networking, so we've delivered things like Bluetooth data transfer, peer networking, either with Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, and proximity connections through near-field communication. So all these things we delivered in Windows Phone 8, we processed some 90% of the top box requests that came in from the developer community on the phone, and so far the uptake has been really, really good. So one of the things that want to talk about just a little bit further, and I don't want to just keep belaboring the point, but I think the application experiences that matter are the ones that are going to be on multiple screens. And a lot of the competitors that we bump into in the platform space have a point of view about phones and tablets being mobile devices and desktops and notebooks being an entirely separate category. And I think that thinking is reflected through the fact that these are separate feature sets, separate platforms, separate APIs, separate SDKs. They're kind of separate worlds. We fundamentally disagree with that point of view. We think that PC, tablet, and phone should have as much platform commonality and coherence as they possibly can, just to make it fast and easy as possible for developers to get from a great idea to making money and being able to reach customers as quickly as possible. So what we've done is we've released what I would describe as a huge foundational release for Windows Phone 8 in the sense that it has a shared core with Windows. We have a common set of APIs so you can actually very, very quickly and easily build apps that will run on both places. And you can see by this picture, you can actually have apps that share code on both devices. So this is a huge foundational step for us. We've been talking for the last year or two about bringing a lot of these worlds together. I think the world of write once, run anywhere will continue to be, I think, a little bit mythical. But you can get ever closer to that vision to the point where even though you're building native UX to take unique advantage of what each of these devices can do and in each of these unique screen sizes, under the covers, as Ben showed earlier, there's the opportunity to share code across both of these experiences and just be very, very efficient and very, very fast. So what I'd like to do is invite Ben back out and take us a little bit deeper into how we're going to do that in the platform. Welcome back.
Thanks.
It's been a long time.
Tim. All right. So I'm actually logged in this time, so I'm ready to go. So as Tim said, there is this huge convergence that's happening at Microsoft between these platforms, Windows 8 and Windows Phone. Windows 8 introduced the Windows runtime, and we spent a lot of time talking about that. Windows Phone also took many of those advances and has incorporated many of those features and functions into the API, or the SDK that we have today. Now, optically, when you look at an app, a Windows Phone or a Windows 8 app, the thing that you notice, first of all, is the UI. And the UI between Windows Phone and Windows 8 certainly is very similar. There's a very similar design, and they're inspired by the same things. But that's not really where you get the most bang for your buck. If you think about it, Windows Phone is actually a little bit different than Windows 8, right? So if you look at form factors, for instance, Windows Phone The screens are always much smaller, right? Less than 5 inches usually. Windows 8, the screens start at 10 or more inches and can go up to even as high as 80 inches if you want. You have different types of screens. In Windows Phone, you have 3 different screen sizes, but all of them are sort of in a portrait landscape, whereas Windows 8 is always landscape. You also have different forms in Windows 8, where you have, of course, the full screen view, you have snap view, you have fill view, and so on. And so what I'm saying, I guess, is don't worry so much about trying to reuse all of your XAML and your UI. The form factors between Windows 8 and Windows Phone are quite different. You can obviously use the same skills. You may be able to reuse some of your controls and some of your designs. But where you get the most bang is actually in the code. And that's what I'm going to spend the next few minutes looking at. So I'm going to look at 2 different apps. The first one is a very simple one. Let me bring it up. This one is actually just a very simple app. And actually, Nick Harris is going to talk about Windows Azure later, and he's going to dive into what this app is doing behind the scenes. But for me, what I'm using it for is just as an example of a very simple app and what it does. And so let's run the app. I'm going to run the Windows 8 app. Let me set that as startup, and I'll run it. And the app doesn't really do a whole lot. It's a to-do app. Some of you may have seen it. It's one that we've used before. And I'm just going to insert a to-do. And let me save that. So now on the left-hand side, I'm entering. On the right-hand side, it's actually querying my data that's actually in the cloud using Windows Azure Mobile Services. So of course, I would want to do the same thing in Windows Phone. And so if I come back to Visual Studio and run this now in Windows Phone, I've got to stop the Windows 8 app. And you'll see it does pretty much the same thing. So the question is, how much code can I reuse between these 2 different apps? Of course, the UI is very similar, but as you can tell, there's much less room, and so I had to move things around. So I don't get a lot of benefit from that. Of course, I'm using the same skills. It's still XAML. I can use the same controls, still using the button and edit controls and all of that good stuff. But where it starts to get interesting is if we look behind the scenes. And so if we look at this solution, you'll see that there's actually one solution that has 3 projects. It's got one project that is a portable class library, and two other projects. One is a Windows 8 project, and the other one is a Windows Phone project. And these projects are sharing a great deal of code. And so let's look at what's going on. The first one, again, this is a very simple example. I'll show you a better one in a couple of minutes. Here's my portable class library. If I look at this, there it is. Let me look at the properties of that. And you'll see it's just a standard portable class library. And I've told it that I have 4 target environments. Really only I need Windows Phone 8, I need Windows Store, and .NET is probably all I could use. And then in there, I've got my standard class for my to-do item, which has my ID, it's got text, and it's got that checkbox for completed or not completed. Now, by putting that in a portable class library, what that means is that code, that binary, is reusable between Windows 8 and Windows Phone. And so by putting as much of the shareable code in that portable class library and then calling it when I need it, I can reuse that code as is. I don't have to make any changes. It's binary compatible. And then if I go to Windows 8, you'll see here there's only one page, so let me just open up this page. You'll see that I am using that portable, techdays.portable, and then taking full advantage of that in my view model. Now, if I come and look at, there's one other area, and that's in the shared folder. You'll see that there is a view model. Whoops, it's already open somewhere. There it is. And so you'll see this view model here has a few things that are kind of interesting. One is it's got its own namespace. By doing that, I can move it back and forth. And in fact, you'll see that there is a conditional compiler directive here, .netfx_core, means that when it's compiling it for Windows 8, it'll use this line. When it's compiling for Windows Phone, it'll use this line. And by doing that, I can share this exact same code between those two applications. And so you'll see that if I, let's see, if I zoom in here, you'll see that the view model, you'll see that it's actually linked, whereas up here it's the actual file, this one is linked. So if I make a change to this view model, that change, anytime I recompile, will be the exact same file recompiling into the two different folders. The other interesting thing here is that we can use all sorts of other techniques. And let me just show you another example. This is called PixPresenter, and it uses those exact same techniques. In addition to using things like MVVM and wrapping your view models and your data models into your portable class library, because those are the things that you're most likely to be able to reuse, wrapping them up and putting them in your portable class library. And then there are some things that you will see are common across the two platforms. For instance, in this case, this is an example of an app that allows someone using NFC from a phone to a device to be able to connect between the two devices. There's an API set for that in the SDK for Windows 8. It's almost the exact same API set in Windows Phone. And so I can share that directly. So if I come into the PixPresenter here and look at shared, no, I think it's in my views. Sorry, view models, rather. And here I'm looking at Peer Connector. You see, again, it's got that little glyph on the icon because I've got it open already. And the reason for that is, again, it's being shared between those two files. It's exactly the same file. And so if I look at this, you'll see that this exact same file, because it's virtually identical, there is one place where there is a conditional compiler that's making a few different changes depending on whether I'm Windows Phone or Windows 8. But if not for that, it's pretty much identical between the two. And so I guess I'm on a mission. My mission is that developers that are building for Windows 8 should be building for Windows Phone. You should plan that way, because you get that much more reach for your application, and it's actually a small amount of additional code for one or the other. And it's going to vary, of course, from app to app, but anecdotally, I've seen anywhere from 70 to 90% of your code being able to be reused between the two platforms, depending on what you're doing. So again, I encourage you, as you're planning your Windows 8 development or your Windows Phone development, or perhaps you have a Windows Phone 7 app that you're thinking you're going to upgrade to Windows Phone 8, as you're doing that, use some of these tips, techniques, patterns, best practices to build for both of these. The convergence between these two platforms is very real, and you'll see that over time, you will be able to deploy, and you'll get that many more users and make a lot more money. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about the store. Obviously, none of this matters if we're not monetizing. And you know, the interesting thing about kind of being where we are relative to the market, we've got 2 years or so now of industry data behind us as an industry, not just Microsoft. We all kind of see the same thing in terms of who's making money, who's not, how long is the long tail as it relates to apps in app stores. Some platforms are harder than others to monetize. We have the benefit of being able to apply a lot of this learning into how we help developers on Windows monetize their apps. And so we've taken an approach with Windows to really be differentiated in the sense that it's much more flexible. We've reduced a lot of the barriers associated with making money. So just take the Windows 8 store, for example. The 70-30 revenue split accelerates to 80-20 once you reach a certain revenue threshold of $25,000 US. So companies like Rovio, Angry Birds, and Zepto Labs with Cut the Rope are in that category. We've reduced the barriers associated with commerce platforms. If you want to use your own commerce platform, it's fine with us. Keep 100% of the money. We also have partnerships with companies like PayPal that will provide commerce platform capability in the back end if you prefer to use PayPal instead of Microsoft. If you want to use a third-party ad platform, that's fine with us too. You don't have to use Microsoft advertising if you don't want to. And so we've taken a lot of the barriers away associated with making money. And we think this is hugely differentiating for Windows. And we think, you know, given that we kind of are where we are in the industry timeline, we think the time is right for a little bit of disruption in that space. Now let me spend a few minutes talking about Windows in the cloud. And, you know, the primary thing that I would have you take away from this section is that our cloud platform is Windows. I will talk about Windows Azure and Windows Server, and I'll talk about how they're the same, how they're different. But at the end of the day, our cloud platform is Windows. It is just Windows. And there are some attributes of this that I'll go into a little bit of detail on. But the first thing I want to do is really step back from that and put a stake in the ground about what cloud computing actually is. Because people tend to get a little tangled up in the on-premises versus off-premises debate as it relates to cloud, and we still get questions from customers about, if something is on-premises, how can it be a cloud app? I don't understand it. I thought cloud was just in the cloud. Cloud computing is really defined by a set of attributes, right? If it's on-demand, if the resources, the compute, the storage, the networking is pooled, if it's metered and measurable in that way, if it can scale elastically very, very quickly and easily, these are the things that really define the design point for cloud computing. So the strategy for Windows in the back end is to give you the ability to meet this design point regardless of where the service is actually running. And this is an important piece, because for a lot of companies, especially a lot of the big companies, certainly a lot of companies in Europe, where there's obviously a lot of regulation around where data resides, there's I think a lot of affinity toward what cloud computing has to offer in terms of the efficiency of resource consumption, pooling, things like that. But at the same time, there's a regulatory environment that needs to be looked after in terms of where these things run. And so one of the key strategy pillars in Windows is that we give you the deployment choice. What we've done in Windows is taken that design point and implemented it ourselves in our data center. And we sell access to it to the public on a pay-as-you-go basis, and that's what Windows Azure is. But we can also sell you software in a box called Windows Server, and you have the ability to implement that same design point yourself. Both Windows Server and Windows Azure have a fully capable, highly scalable web server platform and IIS. The application platform for both Windows Server and Windows Azure is .NET. And .NET 4.5 has all sorts of great capabilities, like support for asynchronous programming, which is a very common app pattern in cloud computing. This is all about giving you the ability to implement that design point when and where you want. We happen to think that the future, the path forward for cloud computing, is going to be some combination of both. Obviously, for new apps and for startup companies, you'd be crazy to stand up a server for any reason at all. But as you start getting into medium-sized and larger companies, these hybrid type environments, I think, reflect the reality of business computing. And I really feel we're the only player in the industry taking this approach. I know Amazon and Google, for example, are betting squarely on public cloud. That's not a criticism of anything they're doing. That's more of a statement of just where they've chosen to focus their energy. Whereas at the same time, we have companies in the commercial package software space that we've competed with in the enterprise for a long, long time, like Oracle and IBM, that are telling the cloud story through the lens of things that they sell to customers that reside on-prem. We think the future is going to be a combination of both. Now, the thing that's, I think, interesting to developers, quite obviously, is the platform side. And people don't generally associate Windows with open, but I would submit to you that we've probably got one of the most open cloud platforms in the industry today. We have done a bunch of work in the platform to make this as accessible to as many developers as possible. So Windows, for example, interoperates with standard protocols like REST, JSON, AtomPub, and others. Windows supports the programming languages you like to code in, whether it's .NET, Java, Node, Python, PHP, or others. Windows supports popular open source frameworks and technologies like Hadoop, MongoDB, CouchDB, MySQL, and others.
we actually give back to the open source community by open sourcing parts of .NET and providing multiple libraries for non-Microsoft technologies that we publish out on GitHub. In the case of Windows Azure, our public cloud, you can actually deploy Linux virtual machines onto Windows. It's in preview now. It'll be in release later on in the year. But Linux running on Windows, I think, is a material shift away from how most people thought about Microsoft in previous years. And you can actually deploy Linux VMs to Windows from desktop Linux or Mac. We provide you tools to do that. So we've done a bunch of work here. If you're using a Facebook ID, Yahoo ID, Google ID, or any other open ID, we can work with that identity in Windows. So lastly, I want to talk about the fact that it's enterprise grade. We have a lot of huge customers, tens of thousands of customers using Windows Azure for different things. But the question we get most often is, who at Microsoft is using this thing? You know, tell me when you start using Windows Azure for your own cloud stuff. Well, parts of Bing use Windows Azure, Office 365 uses Windows Azure, and Halo 4 uses Windows Azure. Specifically, we use parts of the Windows Azure Service Bus to marshal in all of the data that comes from console play as it relates to multiplayer, and we bring it into Waypoint, which is kind of the central hub for the Halo community. We also helped the Halo team deal with the inevitable spikes that occur immediately after launch. You don't want to have to spend all your capital building up to meet that capacity only to have traffic trail off after launch. Windows Azure helped the team deal with that. So lastly, the bridging technologies that kind of connect these two, a common identity platform in Active Directory, a common virtualization platform in Hyper-V, the application platform in .NET, a common tool set in Visual Studio. If you're coding in VS, you can deploy to Windows Azure, Windows Server just as easily, and a common management set of technologies in System Center, so you can look after all this stuff through a single pane of glass. Now, I want to drill down a little bit into Windows Server and talk about the thing that matters most, I think, to people that are building device experiences. You know, we talked a lot about the need to have cloud services running in the back end for everything from just storing assets and storing data to providing notifications to the front end, to managing identities and so forth. So one of the things that we've done in Windows Azure, which is so much more than just storage, compute, and networking, it's traffic management, content delivery, all those things. One of the key services, though, is mobile services to provide kind of that key back end for device experiences. So with that, I'd like to invite Nick up to give us a quick demo of what we're doing in Windows Azure Mobile Services.
Thank you, Tim.
Hey, Nick.
And hello, everybody. There's quite a few people here. Good to see you. All right, so I'll just log in here. While I log in, who here is a Windows Store developer? Anyone? What about mobile devices in general? Android? Okay. I know who you are. I can see one. Okay, that's good. I'm glad this presentation will be useful for you. Let's log in here. Who thought they were here to watch a completely different video? Perhaps a movie? No? We're all here for the keynote? Okay, we're all awake. Okay, let me cut across. All right, so earlier Ben showed us the to-do list application. Now, what I've done with that application is I've actually rolled out a lot of his changes to make it essentially a local Windows Store application that persists, you know, your to-do task list items to your, you know, your local application space. So if I say task one here, hit save. This task is actually saved locally, and it's not connected to the cloud. So what I'd like to show you today is how you can use Windows Azure Mobile Services to build out applications that have a connected experience. So Windows Azure Mobile Services is essentially a powerful turnkey backend solution for your mobile device applications. It provides things out of the box that mobile developers typically need, like an easy way to perform or push structured data up into the cloud, an easy way to read that data back. It provides you the capability to send push notifications, to easily turn on auth with popular social identity providers, and also to run scheduled scripts. So we'll see a few of them today. So the first thing that my application here needs is a mobile service as a back end. So to do that, we can use the Windows Azure portal. And within the portal here, if you wish to create a mobile service, it's as simple as selecting mobile services, new, mobile service, create, and following this wizard. Now, because I want to show you a few features today, I've actually pre-created one here called Keynote. I can click into this. Now, the first thing I'm going to want to do for my mobile service here or my task list application is to have a table that I can store my data in. So we're going to need to store to-do items. I'll hit go on that. And I'm also going to, for push, going to need to store channels. So I'm going to create a table for that as well. So with that, we've got two tables that are there ready to start accepting data. The next thing we need to do is to tell our application how it can connect to this mobile service. So if I cut across here to the quick start, you can see that we've got quick starts for each device platform, Store, Phone 8, iOS, and Android. And I'm actually very proud to announce that as of yesterday, we publicly announced support for Android. So that's a big step forward for the mobile services platform. So if I come down here, if you're starting a new application, you'll probably start with creating a new Windows Store app, and you can download a sample. We're connecting an existing app, so I'm going to copy this, hit copy, and we're going to drop back to our application here, and I'm going to drop this in. Now, this mobile services client is actually residing within the mobile services client SDK, which I've pre-installed and referenced in this app here. But essentially, this class provides a gateway for us to perform CRUD operations against our mobile service, and also perform things such as login and things like that. So you can see that it's hitting the Keynote subdomain on azuremobile.net, and it's got an application key here. So that's part one. So now we need to actually use this to start writing our data to our mobile service. So it turns out, with the client SDK, we've spent a lot of time in trying to make the API as simple as possible for you to go and utilize this to, say, store data or log in. So if I now say app.mobile service, to perform an insert operation, all I need to do is say, not login in progress, but get table, get a handle to the table that I want to insert the item to, which is to-do item, and then I can call insert async, and I can simply pass my to-do item up. So that's it, one line of code, and you're already able to go and serialize this entity, my to-do item, up into Windows Azure, into that table that we've created. And if you note, we haven't actually gone off and defined any schema for this table. So we use a thing called dynamic schematization to interrogate the entities you're passing up and then determine what columns you need. So let's have a look at some other CRUD operations here. So if I want to say, I'm going to use some snippets here. I'm sure you don't want to watch me type all morning. But an update, again, get a handle to the table, call update async. If I want to perform a query, again, get a handle to the table, in this case use where, and provide a link expression to filter the result set coming back, then bind it to your list. So with that, our application here is now connected to Windows Azure. We can spin this up. I'm going to drag it into Snap View here. I'm going to bring up the portal, and we're going to select our data tab and drill into the to-do item table. Now, let's add an item. We won't see it pop up here directly because we don't have WebSockets implemented or anything like that. We'll have to hit refresh. But let's say, let's demonstrate data. That's what we're doing now. Let's say, let's show auth. Let's show push. And maybe we'll show a surprise. So there we go. Data auth push. I've saved those items. I can complete items. You can see if I refresh here, that data is actually now live and up within our mobile service. What do you think of that as far as connecting an application to the cloud? Awesome. Pretty easy, right? A couple of minutes, and we're already storing data up there. Okay, so that's that. What about auth? So if I'm building out any kind of web tier and I want my mobile applications to connect to it, how do I secure these things? So in the case of mobile services, we've tried to make essentially the process of doing that incredibly simple. So if we look down the right here, you can see that we can come configure different identity providers. We've got Microsoft account, Facebook, Twitter, and Google. I've already pre-configured Twitter and Google in this case. So we're going to use Twitter to log into our application. So we've got the config done, but now we want to actually lock down perhaps our service tier on our to-do item table. To do that, simply come in, select permissions, and then we can come down here and say only authenticated users can insert, update, delete, and read. Can now save this off. And with that, our service is now locked down. If I try to insert something here, we'll see that the application will crash because it's unauthorized. So already our web tier is secure. So how do we actually make our client able to now connect to that service and utilize those CRUD operations in an authenticated manner? It's as simple as saying await app.mobile service login async. And then we pass in the provider that we want to utilize. So you'll note here we've got Facebook, Google, Microsoft account, Twitter. In this case, we want to use Twitter. If you wanted to surface all of those, you could do it in some kind of list view and just have a switch in the button press behind the scenes, and you could have the users essentially having the option to log in with any of those identity providers. But now, again, one line of code, and bam, here we are, the common web authentication broker view here for logging in. Give it a second to load there, and there it is. That it? Yeah. it wouldn't be a secret if I told you guys, right? So let's put in my prop one here. All right, I hope that's right. Nope. I can't exactly show you guys, can I? One more time. Oh, man, come on. Someone to come and type this for me. Okay, hit authorize. There we go. Third time works a charm. Now we're authenticated. We can go and we can now access those operations which we've locked down. So again, very simple experience, only a couple of minutes. And within that, we've already now added data and authentication to our service in the cloud. So the next thing that we want to do is let's look at push notifications. Push notifications allow you to control your live tiles, for instance. Every one of these live tiles has what we call a channel URI, and that's basically a target that you can send push notification to, be it a live tile or a toast notification. If you look here, there's a number of different template types. There's ones with images, there's square ones, there's wide ones, there's ones with text. These are all controlled by a push notification. So what I'd like to show you is how you can actually do that within your applications with mobile services. So if I click back to the app here, I've got a stub here for registering a channel. So let's drop in snippet for that, and it requires two real steps. The first one to request a channel from the WinRT API. The next step that I'm doing here is essentially to take the channel URI, so that's what we're going to target the notification at, and I'm just putting this into a channel entity that I'm serializing up to my mobile service. So to save that entity, I call getTableOnChannel this time, and I pass up that channel DTO. So that's the client piece done. If I return back to my server here, we can select the push tab in this case, and I've gone and pre-configured the auth tokens required for Windows Store applications here. If you're using Apple, there's Apple push notification settings and our Google Cloud messaging settings here if you're doing Android applications. MPNS, we don't provide an auth mechanism for that if you're doing Windows Phone apps. So that's it for push as far as the client piece is done. Server side's configured, but we actually have to send that push notification. And the way that we can do that is we can hook into what's called, that's pretty handy, we can hook into what's called a server-side script. Now, server-side scripts allow you to, that's not cool, is it? There we go. Server-side scripts allow you to write your own business logic on the server side. So typically, you'd want to use that for things like validation, say. You may want to validate your entities as they're passed up. You may want to call third-party services. You may want to add a date added or date updated to it. But in any case, server-side script, we can control what happens in that CRUD operation pipeline across each of these operations. And in this case, as I insert an item, I actually want to take that item and send a push notification. So I've got some script here. We'll have a quick look at it. The first thing we do is we call request.execute. Now, that will insert the to-do item that we're passing up here. On success, I respond to the client and call send notifications. This piece of code here essentially gets a handle to the channels table and then grabs the channels from that and iterates through each one of those. On finding each of those channels, we call this function, and I say, well, if it's a Windows device, I want to go and send a push notification. Now, I want you to focus on this namespace, push.wns. Push.wns is used for Windows Store apps, and to send a toast notification, it's as simple as calling the appropriate overload for the template you want. In this case, I'm calling toastimagetext01, and I'm targeting this at a channel URI, and it's actually got an image and the item text within it. We're also sending a tile update and a badge update. If it's not Windows, I'm going to send a message to an Android device in this case. Let's hit save. And with that, Our change is up, it's live, it's running already, there's no publish required. I can hit run on this client application, and that will now go and register that channel up to my service after I log in successfully this time. All right, so now if I go and add an item, let's say this is a to-do list, barbecue a chicken. Let's do that. So there you go, toast. I'm being told to barbecue a chicken. Let's go over and check out our tile. We can see the badge update come through. It's downloading the image now, and any second we should see that tile update come through and be rendered on our screen. You can do it. A little bit slow. There it is. There's some barbecue chicken. All right. So that's push. All right. The last thing I want to close on is cross-device platform experiences. So you'll note here I have an Android emulator, and I've got some actual code written here in Java using the mobile services client SDK for Android. You can see similar experience, mobile services client. The app's running here. Let's hope the internet connection is still working. I think I have a few seconds left. It's not Hotmail on this one, is it? Let's say... There we go. None of you saw that, right? Let's sign in. We don't want to remember that. And with any luck, we're still connected to the internet. And it's now going, hitting our service, and hopefully pulling down those items that we've already added. Let's grab this guy, put it over here. And there you go. You can see the ones that we've done there, and say, hello from Android. Typo, it's okay. They don't mind, right? It's going now, saving. And once it's saved, we'll see a toast and... Hey presto, hit refresh over here, bam, cross-device platform experience. So mobile services provides you a powerful turnkey backend solution. In about 12 minutes, we saw data, auth, push, and a cross-device experience between Windows Store and Android. So thank you very much, guys. And Tim, would you like to come back up?
Yep.
Thanks, Nick. So As Nick said, we're not at all confused about the amount of device development going on out there in the world today, so we spend a fair amount of time at iOS and Android meetups doing exactly that demo. So lastly, we want to talk a little bit more deeply about Visual Studio. What you've seen is a taste of what we're delivering in the tools to make it very, very easy to deliver these apps, or to build these apps. But the wealth of investment that we've made in our tooling suite goes far beyond just what we've shown to date. So what I'd like to do is invite Brian Keller up to take us deeply through the world of ALM for Visual Studio 2012. Hey, Brian.
Thanks, Tim.
Oh, you need that.
Yep, thank you. All right, good morning, everyone. So I know what you're thinking. You've seen a lot today. There's a lot of increased challenges being placed on you as developers to go out and deliver great software. And so our job on the application lifecycle management team back at Microsoft is really to help get the tools out of the way so that you can do your jobs as software developers. Now, of course, I'm sure most of the people in this room are familiar with Team Foundation Server. Team Foundation Server is really the heart of Microsoft's integrated application lifecycle management portfolio. So, of course, into Team Foundation Server, we deliver a rich experience for Visual Studio developers. We also have a rich plugin for Team Explorer Everywhere that plugs into Eclipse. And you may have seen recently that we've also gotten into the distributed version control game recently by adding Git as a version control option in Team Foundation Service. And we'll be bringing that on premises as well in the next major release of Team Foundation Server. But the key all along here is to make sure that we give you this integrated experience. So across the family, you'll be able to link your work items to your source control, whether that's Git or the traditional Team Foundation version control. You can link that to your builds. And then all the way, by being able to link across those artifacts, you get traceability into the system that allows you to start answering questions like, what was the purpose of this particular check-in? It was to fix this bug, and it showed up in last night's build. So in addition to linking all those artifacts, the other thing that we want to do is make sure that we're pulling together all of the different roles that participate in the application lifecycle management process. Obviously, that starts with developers, but as developers, you need to get a lot of great requirements from your stakeholders, and we have this problem all the time where oftentimes it's difficult to understand exactly what our stakeholders are asking us for. So in the 2012 release, we've baked stakeholders as a role directly into the tooling. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we also have operations included as well. Of course, our job as software developers isn't done the moment we produce a final build because we're oftentimes expected to support that solution in production. The other thing that we're seeing as trends is this idea of being continuous. Every day when I wake up and I look at my Windows phone, I look for that little number next to the store icon to say that I have application updates. Users expect that we're going to be shipping software continuously and that we're not going to force them to wait 18 to 24 months like they may have in the past for the next version of your software to come out. Now, we want to support that, but with that comes a big challenge on development teams to be able to respond continuously to the feedback, to be able to continuously push out to production, and the entire time you need to make sure that you have quality baked in as a tenet of your application so that you have the confidence when you make a change that you didn't just break some feature that was working last week. So I'm going to take you through just a few quick demonstrations. Those of you that were in the pre-con yesterday saw a lot of these demos. We spent the entire day looking across everything that you can do with Visual Studio 2012 and TFS. I'm just going to show you a few of my favorite features. The first is in that area of stakeholder interaction. So when you're working with customers, trying to understand their requirements, it's really important that you understand what those requirements are before you start investing in the expensive lines of code, which are much more difficult to change later on. The other thing that you need to manage is the conflicting priorities across all of your teams. Now, frameworks like Agile and Scrum give you a lot of great guidance for being able to do that. And so in this release, we've really doubled down our investment in the tooling support for those methodologies. So let me just switch over here and I'll show you a couple of these demos. The first of which is how to integrate your customers into the design experience. And so you may have seen this. This is our new PowerPoint storyboarding add-in that ships with Visual Studio 2012. It turns out that PowerPoint is actually a really great tool for doing storyboards in for a couple of reasons. Number one, it already supports shapes and animations and a lot of the tooling that goes into providing a great storyboarding experience. But the other great thing about using PowerPoint here is that most business users already have PowerPoint. They already have some basic familiarity with it. So I can put together this deck, I can send it to somebody, and they can easily understand what it is that I think we're supposed to be building. So we can have a really high fidelity conversation around that. Now, creating a storyboard is really simple. I can just add a new slide here. I can map that maybe to an existing layout that I created earlier. We can give that a URL. And then we can look at this rich shapes library over here. And so the shapes library has shapes for Windows Store, for Windows Phone, for web applications. And then if you click down here to go to the Visual Studio Gallery, you can access other shapes as well for iOS, for Android, and so on. So there's new shapes being added all the time. So I can maybe create a button, and we'll just quickly stylize this. Maybe we can give it a fill color. And then once I get that button exactly the way that I want it, I can actually save that to my shapes, and I can share those with other people on my team. The other thing that I can do is I can actually take in existing screenshots very easily from maybe brownfield applications that I'm modeling storyboards for. So I can easily just grab this screenshot. And you get the idea. So let's say that this is what my customer wants me to go build. The next thing I need to do is actually schedule this work. And to do that, one of the things that we've invested in with Team Foundation Server 2012 is a really rich web access experience for working with your project team and the corresponding work that that team is going to be working on. So here you can see my team's homepage. You can see I have all the work that's important to my team, my work item queries, my builds, my burn down, and then I can just click over to the backlog to add some new work. So one of the things that I might want to do is take advantage of the new mobile services support for Android that my colleague Nick was just showing. So we can say that we want to add an Android app. And we could just press enter, and that will add it straight to our backlog. This backlog is really nice because it allows us to very easily have a conversation with the customer about when specific features are going to show up. And it does this by projecting the velocity of my team against the work that's currently in the backlog. So it's very easy for me to come in here and have a conversation with a customer where maybe they want to change around the priority of some of this work based on the velocity and based on the size of these work items. So again, this is all just a nice web-based experience. We also support a new Kanban board as well. So those of you that are practicing lean development, Kanban's a really popular way to visualize the continuous flow of value throughout the system. So maybe we want to take this Android app and really prioritize this. So we'll slide it over to our current sprint, and we'll start to break down that work into individual tasks that my team will implement. So maybe I need to design this app, and we'll ask Annie to work on that. And then, of course, it would be nice if we actually dev'd this app as well. And you can see that as soon as I've done this, my team is now pushed over capacity. So Team Foundation Server gives me a really nice visual indication. My team is over capacity. And in order to deal with that without irritating my team, I might take some of this work and just push it back onto the backlog. And we'll deal with that in a future iteration. Now, we can update this plan on a daily basis. Maybe during my stand-up meetings, I can come in here. If somebody is out sick, we can make an adjustment to the plan, and then we're back and on track. So once we get this plan exactly the way we want, we can switch over to the task board. And this is our modern-day implementation of Post-it notes on a whiteboard. This works really well with a touchscreen monitor as well. So a lot of the customers I work with are setting up nice big touchscreen monitors in their team rooms. And then you can just update this on the way to the break room, and then that way we can track the work that your team is doing. So those are just a couple of the ways that we're helping you engage with the customer throughout the development lifecycle. Let's switch gears and let's talk a little bit more about what you probably care most about, which is how do I be successful as a developer and be productive doing my job throughout the day. One of the challenges that you see when you start working in an agile environment is that oftentimes your priorities are shifting from one to another. So the requirements I was working on this morning maybe aren't the highest priority by the time we have another conversation with our customer and realize that they need us to make a high pry bug fix or change the way that a particular feature works. Now, we can't prevent you from having interruptions, but what we can do is help you deal with those interruptions in a more productive way to help get you back on track once you're switching context from one piece of work to the other. The other challenge that we want to solve is that as you're developing your software, wouldn't it be nice to get some really high fidelity feedback from your customer about whether or not you're on track based on their expectations of what you're building? So if we switch back again here, I'll just show you in Visual Studio how easy it is to take some of this work that maybe is in progress and actually suspend this work. So here you can see I have some file edits, I have some breakpoints set, and over on the right-hand side, we have this new area called My Work. My Work allows you to see all the work that's currently scheduled to you. So this is a list of all the tasks that are currently assigned to me. It also allows you to take work that's in progress and go ahead and suspend that work. And when I do this, it's going to back up all of my changes on Team Foundation Server. So even if my laptop dies, I'll be able to get access to those edits later on. And so now I can go do that high priority bug fix. And once I'm ready, I can switch gears back into this work and just resume that. It's going to not only hydrate those files, but it also restores the state of my Visual Studio environment back to where I was at. So the same breakpoints, the same tool windows, if I had multiple monitors, everything set up exactly the way that it was so that I can be productive again. You'll notice over here, I can also do things like request code reviews of other team members, and all of that conversation gets tracked right within Team Foundation Server. So that's very nice. I also mentioned that we want to be able to checkpoint with our customer. So let's go back and ask our customer to provide us with some feedback about whether or not the application we've built meets their expectations. So when I do this, I can ask Cameron to visit our staging website. We can tell him to log in as a test user. And we can ask him, does the employee page provide the right functionality? And when I do that, that's going to generate an email that Cameron will receive, and it will look something like this. And basically, this is asking him, if he hasn't already, to install the free Microsoft Feedback client. He already has this installed, so we'll just launch that Feedback client. And the idea here is very simple, that in the background, the Feedback client is going to be the next best substitute to actually being in the room with Cameron as he's using your application. So over here on the left-hand side, you'll see that I can actually capture video recordings. I can capture audio annotations if he wants to turn that on, or he can just start providing comments. So I love the new UI. And then if we go over to the employees page, which is what I was asking for his feedback on, then maybe he wants to, you know, quickly grab a screenshot. Once this loads here, well, we'll just grab a screenshot here. So we've grabbed a screenshot, and then maybe we want to just quickly annotate this to say that, you know, it'd be really nice if we had the employee ID column listed on this particular view. Please add employee ID. And so when I save that, that goes straight back into Team Foundation Server so that when my product owner gets back to their desk and they look at the feedback that came right in from Cameron, they're going to see this work item that has everything that Cameron filed. The really nice thing about that is that this work is saved directly in Team Foundation Server. I could create a new bug based on the feedback that I got from Cameron, and then when the developer goes to pick up that bug, they'll see in Cameron's own words exactly what he was asking for. So there's much less risk of this communication breakdown happening between what your customers are telling you and what you as a developer are actually implementing. Once again, the feedback client is free, and you don't even need to have a client access license in order for stakeholders to engage with Team Foundation Server in this manner. So let's just wrap up by showing you one last stanza here, which is the operation stanza. So as a developer, your job isn't done the moment you hand it off to production. And there's a couple of different things that you need to worry about as a developer. Number one, how do you push those changes out to a production environment in a reliable and efficient manner? Now, I won't have time to show you lab management. Yesterday, we took a deeper look at lab management. But lab management is a technology that allows you to really easily set up build, deploy, test workflows. So Tim mentioned Xbox. The Xbox team is actually using lab management today so that they can make a change maybe to the way that leaderboards or achievements works. And then a few minutes later, they can automatically have that provisioned in a staging environment. They can run all their automated tests, and then their manual testers can start to validate that everything looks from a gamer's perspective. So very, very cool technology that you can get started with now in just a matter of minutes. The other problem is once something actually goes wrong in the production environment, it can become very difficult to isolate the issue and understand from a debugging perspective what's going on. I don't know about you, but if you've ever tried to install Visual Studio in a production environment, you probably haven't been allowed to do that. But the next best thing here is that when you do have a problem going on in a production environment now, we allow you to use a tool we shipped in 2010 called IntelliTrace. We've extended that in 2012 so that you can use that in a production environment. So if you come back over to my machine, you'll see that this is our production website. And you know, most of the time it's working okay, but occasionally our issues are reporting that they're receiving this error. So on the production machine, my operations team can actually just install this set of PowerShell commandlets, and really it's an Xcopy deployment. Nothing's getting installed or registered on the machine. And what they do is they can start executing the IntelliTrace scripts against their ASP.NET web application, and we can capture rich log files that you can then take from the production environment back to your desk and open up with Visual Studio. And what you can see here is that when I open up this log file back on my developer desktop, it's almost as if I'm connected to the machine and setting a debugging breakpoint. But remember that this actually was captured from a production environment, and it may have been captured hours ago. So IntelliTrace does a really great job of capturing exactly what's going on and packaging that up in an event-based way that allows you to see exactly what's going on. So here, this is where we had our null reference exception. I can see the local values as they were right when this exception was hit. We can also take a look at IntelliTrace and go back in time through those events. Maybe the reason this happened was that we weren't able to initialize the value because we couldn't access the SQL Server database on another machine. Anything is possible, and with IntelliTrace, you can go back in time and really understand exactly what was happening on your application. So with that, I would encourage you to go take a look at Visual Studio 2012 and Team Foundation Server 2012. 2012. And with the new cloud-based Team Foundation service, you can do everything that I showed you here just in a matter of minutes by setting up your free account at tfs.visualstudio.com. Thank you very much.
You know, it's interesting when I talked earlier about all the Android and iOS meetups that we go to talk about Azure Mobile Services in the back end, and all those developers talk about, you know, if only we could use Visual Studio for our other development as well. It continues to be the gold standard for development tools in the industry, and we hear that from non-Microsoft developers all the time. So one of the things, I guess the big thing we wanted to show you today was how comprehensive the investments we've made in the platform are relative to building great device experiences across PC, tablet, and phone with services running in the background. Now, one last thing we want to show you is I'd like to invite up Cortina Grav to walk us through a case presentation of how one of our great partners have brought all these pieces together. So please welcome Cortina.
Hello. Thank you. All right, so as Tim has shown you, together with all of our other speakers today, we are betting on devices, apps, and services. Now, what better than to bring you a case that shows you the combination of those coming together in an application using services. Now, I would like to call up Christoph and Hitte from the Kronos Group to talk about the Tech Days apps. So, have you installed Tech Days apps? Have you heard about them? A few. Okay, so that will change. Right. More hands coming up. Good morning, Hitte. Could you please introduce yourself?
Well, I'm Hitte. I'm working as a software consultant at Kronos, and I helped develop the Tech Days app for Pocket Pro, a Kronos company, which does mobile development.
Right, and Christoph?
Good morning. So I'm Christoph. I'm working within the Kronos Group for a company called AppStory, and there I'm responsible as an architect for all Microsoft Stack technologies, so working on Windows Azure, Windows 8, and Windows Phone.
Everything we discussed today?
Yeah, right? Indeed.
In Visual Studio.
Yeah, in Visual Studio, of course.
So, Hitte, could you introduce us to through how you got started in the company building the phone app? And then we'll get to it.
So, what we actually did was another Kronos company called Monkey Shot, they did the actual design for us. They are experts at designing all sorts of applications, but mobile applications for Windows Phone, Windows 8 as well. They know the guidelines, they can hand us the design, and from that we can work on. They also, because of the fact they know the guidelines, we actually afterwards have a very, very smooth approval process once we go to the store.
So right, implementing the new modern UI guidelines.
Yeah.
And then you got started on, you did XAML for Windows Phone.
Yeah, so we started building the XAML from the original design. We also took all of the assets that MonkeyShot gave us, like all of the images, the font sizes, the coloring schemes, which are in line with the official Tech Days coloring schemes. So that's how we got started, actually.
All right. And then you, on your hand, also, because you worked a lot together on the design, and then you also created you reused those assets for Windows 8?
Yeah, true. So we first took the PSD, which was a Photoshop file. We sliced it. We took the colors, which are basically all the Tech Days colors that you saw in the logo up there. So we just used those to build the app. And then we started laying out the basic grid of the XAML application, which you will see in the demo right away. So the basic grid of all the screens to have some similarities when navigating through the application, so the bar on the left. And basically, we started building our XAML like that and then building page by page to finish the app.
Having the grid framework and then.
True.
Well, maybe let's go to a demo so that we can see. Let's take the device and just try to film it because it will show easier. So we'll hold it up here and you can take the device there.
Yeah, so I'll take the device up here. So we got the Tech Days app with the start screen. Now, once you start the application, you have a panorama control, typical Windows Phone control with two panorama items. We can watch the full program. Again, a panorama control with items grouped first by day, then by time, which was actually one of the harder parts of the application, what's doing the actual grouping. If you want to do this for Windows Phone 7, it's actually a NuGet package to get this specific control. For Windows Phone 8, it's in the actual SDK, so you can use that one. You can see details of each application, and you can also, once you have, when you're on the detail of a certain talk, you can actually add it to your agenda with the bottom at the bottom in the app bar, which is actually kind of cool. Once you've done that, you actually get an extra panorama item on your first screen, which shows you the next sessions you will be attending, which is actually quite handy when you're down in the when you're downstairs and you're like, okay, which is my next session? You actually get it on the first screen, the startup screen of your Windows Phone application. So that's something we gave some consideration.
Which is the useful thing here, all of us walking with devices. Now, maybe take a look at the same, same application, but the application for Windows 8.
Okay, so I'll show you the starting up the app. So if you install it, the first time you load it, it's going to download all the feed data, so all the session data, all the speaker images, everything. It's going to cache it locally. So you only need internet connection the first time you start it up. The next times you can use it offline. So if you're in the room and don't have internet, you can still use it. So basically, this is the grid which I was talking about. So on the left, you see the bar, which will show you all the information which is really needed to navigate through the day. So these are the upcoming sessions. So which are the sessions which are coming next? If you have some sessions which are your favorites, you will see them marked with a star as well. You can, of course, navigate to your to the full program, which will show you immediately day two, because today is day two. So that's basically the focus of the app, is to show you directly the content which you will need at this moment, which today are the sessions of today. So you can browse the program by time slot, find which session you would like to see. If you would like to, you can filter on audience. So say, okay, I want to see all only developer IT pro sessions. If you set a filter, it will also be saved the next time you start up your app, so you can say, okay, I'm interested, this is my filter, my personalized settings. So the next time you start up the app or you reboot your machine, even the settings will still be there. So opening up session details, you see some details about the speaker, the level of the session, if you're interested in level 200, 300, 400. And you can also find some related sessions, which might be handy if you're looking for more sessions about ALM, some sessions about Windows Azure, so you can find related sessions on the right. Some details about the session, so to find is it a session which I'm interested in. And then by opening the app bars, you can add the session to your favorites. So if you add it to your favorites, it will be marked with a star, and you will be seeing the upcoming sessions on the left. Yeah, now I don't have any favorite in the next slot, but it will show you the next sessions, and then it will then it will show you this favorite so that you can browse it. So you also see a link here for my program, which will show you throughout the 3 days which are the favorite sessions which you would like to attend. So immediately a view on your calendar for the 3 days of the event.
Right, and this calendar, if I build it here, can I reuse it on my phone and vice versa?
Yeah, you can. So now I've just added a session to my calendar. So if I, what you can do is you can go to settings, and there is an option which is called synchronization. So for that, we use Windows Azure. So every change you make, your filters or your favorites will be synced back to Windows Azure Mobile Service. So the thing which Nick was talking about, it will save all the data there. Next time, if you have another device, a tablet or another Windows 8 device, Windows Phone device, you can just synchronize based on your Live ID. It will pull that data, and you have your calendar shared on all your devices at all times.
And that's what makes it useful, is to have that application on your device if you have time to configure it, and then have the synchronization, do it on your phone, and go to, from one room to the other. Now, can you highlight a bit the architecture behind it? Let's switch back to the slides. So you can explain the architecture as you used Windows Mobile as Windows Azure Mobile Services and the synchronization, the login.
So basically the...
The slide.
Architecture, in the middle there is Windows Azure Mobile Service. So basically there are two tables, so exactly the same way as Nick showed you. The table which stores your favorites and a table which stores your filters, linked to a user ID, which is just a token you get back from Windows Live. So we didn't integrate with Twitter, but we used Windows Live ID. On the phone, we used Live SDK, because that was the easiest one on the phone side, because it was Phone 7. And on the Windows 8 side, we used Windows Azure Mobile Service Authentication, also the same way as Nick showed you with a web authentication broker, so that you can log in with your Live ID. Why didn't we use the Live SDK there? Because Live SDK on Windows 8 only supports single sign-on. So if you really want to log in with a different account than the one you're using on your machine, the only way to do it is to go through the web authentication broker. We did it with Windows Azure Mobile Services. So this is basically the setup. So on the left side, you have the phone, which is done in XAML C# using Live SDK and communication with Windows Azure Mobile Services based on REST. So just the HTTP protocol. And on the other side, there's Windows 8, where we just used the Windows Azure Mobile Service SDK together with the MVVM. And there we just use Windows Azure Mobile Service authentication mechanism for Windows Live. And bundling those two, they synchronize the data. They put it in a table in the backend, and they can synchronize in both ways.
Interesting thing here, if you go to next session on Azure Mobile Services, you'll do some more
in-depth about how we figured it out. Yes.
All right, thank you very much. Now, I would just like to end with one question, each of you. Any highlight, any challenge on building this app?
Well, what really struck me was that actually we started building the app with making the XAML, something that I did, and there was actually a junior programmer at Pocket Pro who started off from that XAML design, and in my opinion, in minimal time, he wrote the entire app that you all have on your cell phones right now. So I think Hans, who wrote all of the logic for the application, he did a very cool job.
And, deserves a kudo. Kudos. Okay, that's the learning. The learning curve. And from your end, anything?
Yeah, for us, it was the main session overview screen, which is basically a triple nested grid view. So it's on the first level, there's day, so everything is data-based, which we get in, so there's nothing static on this screen. So the first level is the days, the second level are the time slots, which is a grid by itself, and the third level is the sessions itself. So the problem with that is that by nesting those three, you also want the scroll events to pass through to the bottom grid. You also want the mouse wheel support to work on every device, because that's basically the concept of Windows 8, to work with a mouse, keyboard, and touch. And that was the most challenging part, to get this screen up and running on all devices with all the gestures and everything up and running. So,
all right. Well, thank you very much. Hope you all install the apps, the two apps. Just search in the store and enjoy the apps and use the apps during the event. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.